Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 168, and the world by the middle of the 19th century was shifting gears, changing rapidly. Southern Africa was caught in the current of world history, and within a few years, after the discovery of diamonds, for example, the country was going to be very much in the current of world economics. Not that the Cape had not been crucial since the days of the Dutch East India Company, the VOR. As you heard last episode, the British government has fallen. Robert Peel had resigned on the 19th of June 1846 in the wake of political divisions that followed the repeal of the Corn Laws. The imposition of import duties on foreign corn had been attacked for making bread too expensive, and yet the laws were more than a concession to farmers and landowners. They were also the symbol of a barrier against free trade. Ah, yes, the logic and philosophy of laissez-faire capitalism. The repeal of these laws and the change going on must not be underestimated. We forget these things so long ago, of course, at our peril, for we have similar debates going on today, globally. In 1846, the repeal of the laws took place in the midst of the Great Irish Famine, which led to so many Irish men and women fleeing their homeland for America, where they changed that country forever. While the financiers muttered about all the advantages of free trade, they, of course, made sure to leave out one country in their calculations, India. This was always the exception. Still, the financiers were pontificating about how the empire was sort of redundant, and as everyone glanced around for the good and the bad, many found themselves wondering about Southern Africa. This region assumed a pivotal role inside English politics, as it was going to do for the next 150 years. You see, the whole of South Africa was the embodiment of wasteful expenditure without a discernible return on commercial investment. It was a total liability, except for the Cape of Good Hope with its strategically important naval base that allowed the British to cover the South Atlantic and the approaches to the Indian Ocean. Into the political breach strode a man who arrived with Lord John Russell's administration, and he was the third Earl Grey, who took over from William Gladstone as Secretary of State for War and the Colonies. Earl Grey was a free trader, imbued with the spirit of the elixir of cash, the medicine of dosh, and imperial matters were the third Earl Grey's passionate interest. He was a technocrat with a mission, and wrote a book where he pointed out that the great object of possessing colonies was to also possess a monopoly over the commerce in the colonies. He appeared to gloss over one of the biggest failures of this theory, America. The founding fathers and mothers there had taken intense dislike to the British monopoly over things, and the War of Independence was ostensibly about commerce. Earl Grey warned about losing colonies like South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Ceylon, India, the West Indies. "No," said Grey, "Britain should remain in charge there, or there'd be a race war. Or maybe the slave trade would begin anew in the West Indies. They needed the British." That may or may not have been true, but what was undoubtedly true was that his infatuation with the Cape Colony was going to test his own pet theories. The Seventh Frontier War had cost a fortune, so the whole free trade and laissez-faire capitalism trope that he was selling appeared to sit a little at odds with the local establishment. Just to put things in perspective, in 1846, the British Army and Navy gobbled up 28% of the country's annual expenditure, and the figure was rising. In that year, the British had fought a war against the Sikhs in Punjab, which had also cost them dearly. It had also brought to bear that man who we met so long ago who fought the Sikhs, Sir Harry Smith, the hero of the war, at least from London's point of view. That veteran of the Peninsular War against Napoleon and the Sixth Frontier War in South Africa. He was now Major General Harry Smith, and it appeared to the Russell government that a man of his military prowess was needed in the Eastern Cape. The British regarded the Amaxhosa as external to the issues of government. They were regarded as too ignorant and unenlightened, while the settlers, according to reports, were not much better. 2 months would pass from September to November 1846 as Earl Grey and his Colonial Office cronies entertained conference after conference, consultations, reports, more meetings, draft reports, more reports, and then the fine combing of constitutional law books before they thought they'd hit on a formula for the Cape's intractable frontier. What we should realize in the 21st century is that South Africa was another place on the map going through constitutional changes, like Canada at the time, which had already elected its first constituent assembly. Home rule was on the move there. Australia and New Zealand were moving towards it too, and now the impetus grew in the Cape. The big problem, however, in South Africa was the eastern frontier. In Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the indigenous people had been crushed, give or take an incident or two. In South Africa, well, this was something different. The British obsessed about legality, so what was going to happen between the Keiskamma and Kei rivers? Grey knew that his military had to run this area, but was also aware of the great cost of keeping soldiers in their hundreds in this territory. Grey fixated on defeating the Amaxhosa in war. After this conquest, they would be turned into Christianized agriculturists living in municipalities, no longer militarized, their ancient ways eviscerated, and voila, no more need for an army of occupation. That was Plan A, but Grey and other Colonial Office technocrats knew this was a lofty ideal, unlikely. Plan B was swift annexation to the Cape Colony of this region, because then it was back to martial law. Plan B 1.2 was for the British Army to invade the Transkei, Swahili's territory, the Tsaleka, the paramount chief's land. It was known by the odious title Kaffraria, a title that was despised by the Amaxhosa, despite apologists saying, well, it was just a name. Maybe the Transkei could be made a completely separate colony, was what some were saying, a kind of Plan C. It was no surprise that when the plan was finally agreed, it was a copy of a plan that had been drawn up by Governor Benjamin Durban 10 years earlier. The Amaxhosa were to be brought under British authority, and their country would be ruled as a form of British protectorate and a dependency that they would call British Kaffraria. The Governor of the Cape would also be simultaneously the High Commission of British Kaffraria and would have the power for the settling and adjustment of the affairs of the territories adjacent or contiguous to the frontier. Ah, there's that old bugbear of ours, the vague concept of what adjacent and contiguous meant. For some reason, the British believed this was the panacea to their problems in the Eastern Cape, and that this would quickly put an end to the financial hemorrhage going on caused by these repetitive wars between settler and Amaxhosa. Earl Grey turned his gaze to Sir Peregrine Maitland. The governor was 70, and the stress of the Seventh Frontier War had turned him into an octogenarian. A younger man was needed, someone who could sign up young Amaxhosa and turn them into sepoys, and that police their own people. Sepoys were Indian soldiers employed within European military garrisons to provide the much-needed manpower for the defense of colonies in India, and the term sepoy is derived from the Persian word sepai, which had been translated into Urdu and Hindi as a generic term for soldier. In India, there were 300,000 sepoys fighting alongside 40,000 British troops, and the sepoys were paid far less. Grey loved this example of saving the British exchequer while bolstering the power of the colonial empire. This is where another colonial springs into our view. A man who was called a violent-tempered martinet, greedy, ambitious, Sir Henry Pottinger. He'd spent most of his life in the East and had just retired as the first governor of Hong Kong. He'd secured Britain's commerce with that vast country called China, and when he sailed home in 1846, he'd been received as a hero. He'd been given a handsome pension for life and was telling all and sundry he hoped to become the governor of Bombay, which we now call Mumbai. The last thing he wanted was to be sent to South Africa. So when Grey met Sir Henry Pottinger, the latter bluntly refused the Cape governorship. Eventually, Grey was forced to cough up a vast salary of £10,000 a year and promised that the Cape Town post was only temporary. £10,000? So much for reducing expenditure in the Cape. To give you some idea of how much this was in 1846, £100 then was worth around £14,000 today. So he was demanding over £1.5 million to run the Cape in today's cash. But what was the situation? Asked Sir Henry Pottinger. This is where things were somewhat confusing. It was true that part of the Konukwebe had stopped fighting. Maitland had moved a commander into the Transkei searching for Sareli, a pathetic and pointless exercise. The British Army regulars had had it in spades. Their uniforms were now in rags. Many men had no boots or shoes, and now they were forced to march into the Transkei. It was a brief and useless expedition that did secure thousands of head of Amaxhosa cattle, but there was no final battle against the Amaxhosa themselves. What happened next is a kind of warning to all functionaries of any state, but for Sir Peregrine Maitland, it was a dagger to his heart. Grey wrote an urgent dispatch on the 16th of September 1846. Maitland, who was inside the Transkei, actually at the burned-out mission station at Butterworth, just across the border, only received this dispatch on the 6th of January 1847. He'd been tracking Sareli, and his great place was near Butterworth. Grey wrote that he had terminated Maitland's governorship. Maitland was stunned and wrote back immediately, "For the last 7 months, my abode has been a camp in the wilds of Khoisaland. Through the strange vicissitudes of climate to which the country is subject, bitter cold, sickly winds, drenching rains, and the burning rigours of the African sun," he whined, "I am left almost defenceless, exposed to all the attacks which the strong party spirit of the colony echoed in England is likely to make upon me." Anyway, Maitland turned his army around and left for Cape Town. As he passed through Grahamstown, he revoked martial law. Meanwhile, Pottinger was already on his way and poring over Maitland's dispatches. When Pottinger landed in Cape Town on 27th of January 1847, he truly believed that the war on the frontier was over. That, of course, was not true. It had sputtered to a halt, but there was no political agreement, no peace signing. The Amaxhosa were still of the opinion that their land was illegally possessed and that the British wanted to destroy their chieftains. As a sign of the times, Pottinger had headed to South Africa on board a steamship, the Modern World, the great new invention of the mid-19th century, and when he landed, he was gobsmacked. Things were a chaotic mess. Affairs at Government House in Cape Town, he said, were in a positively disgraceful condition, and the reports he was sent on what was really going on along the Eastern Cape frontier made things worse. "So various and contradictory that it is hardly possible to arrive at the real truth," he wrote in a report to Earl Grey. Like other men of action before him, Pottinger didn't hang around Cape Town. He leapt aboard a ship and sailed to Algoa Bay less than 2 weeks later. Maitland had still not sailed home, but that didn't stop Pottinger going to suss out for himself what the dickens was going on. Apparently, Pottinger's fury at being misinformed was legendary. His irascible ways at the best of times now took on an edge that was fierce and terrifying. After the nuance of Indians and the Chinese, the cosmopolitan ambiance of the ancient political protocols, Pottinger walked straight into the Eastern Cape's harsh realities. There would be no soothing beauty or elegance of the Western Cape for this emissary of empire. No, Sir Henry Pottinger was going to be forced to remain in the Eastern Cape for most of his time in Southern Africa. He was not totally healthy. The East had left him with a damaged kidney, worsening his temper. To this former governor of Hong Kong, the Eastern Cape was a shoddy mess. Unholy disorder appeared to be the way of life, made worse by the venality of many of the residents, subterfuge hidden beneath the sunny Eastern Cape weather. Pottinger was to last 10 months in South Africa, and there was possibly not a more unhappy man who ever arrived at our shores, except perhaps for Jan van Riebeeck, who also hated the Cape. But friends, do not underestimate the effect of Sir Henry Pottinger's short stint here. It's thought that his governorship, which was often like a hurricane of unsparing ill will and excoriation, was also the most significant of the first half of the 19th century. Historians like Noel Mostat have gone out of their way to explain why. Up until Pottinger, every governor, both Dutch and English, had tried to hold onto a line of segregation between the colony and the Amaxhosa. For the first time in nearly 40 years, a British governor was going to incorporate Amakosa into the British Empire politically in some form of dependent status, abandoning the previous idea of treaties signed with independent black states. The way that Pottinger set this up was to plan indirect rule through the chiefs themselves, and living alongside these new tame chiefs would be the British political agents. You see, he knew that the previous attempts at destroying the power of the chief was lunacy. He wrote that cessation of all authority of the chiefs over their people was absurd. Because of his extensive experience in India and China, he knew that the chiefs were the glue that bound the people together. The idea, he said, of relieving 30 or 40,000 men from all authority or guidance of their chiefs seems too preposterous that I cannot understand how it could be thought of for a moment. Then, unfortunately for him and his empire, he decided that before this new system was instituted, the Amakosa chiefs had to be properly defeated in battle. Sandile's Ngqika were apparently cultivating their gardens and going about their business peacefully, but local officials were whispering in Pottinger's ear. This was a ploy, they said. It was not a proper peace. So Pottinger reached the conclusion that things cannot be permitted to settle down in the present form. Patu of the Qunuqwebe were still out there, so too Sarhili of the Qaleka. They had to be defeated. But the big problem for Pottinger was that he wasn't a military man. He was a servant of the East India Company, not the British Crown, and rules meant he was unable to lead the South African army, where he had been able to lead the Indian army. Pottinger took personal interest in defeating the Amakosa of Sarhili. He regarded this as a long and serious account to settle, he wrote Grey in a letter. If Patu and Sarhili weren't taught an English lesson, he mused, then the other chiefs would begin to waver. By now, there were 3,000 British troops on the frontier, and like other governors, Pottinger believed the Amakosa should be massively humbled. He wanted at least 4,000 troops and sent word to the islands of St. Helena and Mauritius for reinforcements, and he wanted his old troops from India, the Sepoys, to be sent to support the British army in the Eastern Cape. Joining the new governor was Lieutenant General Sir George Berkeley, who was to lead the British army directly, considering Pottinger's legal position. When Wellington, the Horse Guards Commander-in-Chief, heard about the call for reinforcements, he flatly refused to send these. There are enough soldiers in South Africa to do the job, he told Pottinger. And thus, Pottinger reignited the war that he had spent so much time castigating Sir Peregrine Maitland about. General Berkeley was dispatched to scour the country east of the Kaiskamma River for Patu of the Qunuqwebe, but he was never found. Patu was entertained by the Xhosa warriors' stories of the British floundering around the thickets. For the British soldiers, this was an inglorious hunting of cattle thieves and protecting convoys of wagons from one military post to another. Lieutenant General Berkeley rapidly came to the conclusion that no other war he'd fought anywhere in the world prepared him for Africa, struggling through the bush, encountering something that was beyond his own knowledge. Pottinger was fighting what he called a laxity of system unparalleled in any other part of the Queen's dominions. Ah yes, as we all know, South Africa is definitely not for the squeamish. Nothing quite prepares you for the shenanigans that we get up to. For Sir Henry, he raged. There seems to be something contagious in the colonial air, he thundered. There is not one man in the colony who has not some private motive for his actions. Pottinger, you see, had stumbled on the fact that the colonists and the colonial auxiliaries were deeply involved in graft and profiteering corruption. He discovered fictitious levies were being raised for which clothing and rations were issued to no one, but like the Sassa Grant corrupt officials of the 21st century. He further found out that everything supplied to the army was fiddled in one way or another. What a shock for a man of the system to discover that the system in Southern Africa was rotten to the core. Colonial militia officers were the worst offenders, but the list he eventually sent Grey was extensive. Merchants, tailors, shopkeepers, editors of newspapers, hotel keepers, etc.,
were all dignified with military titles of captains, lieutenants, and only did duty by drawing their pay. He was horrified by the depth of corruption. Nothing of the sort could be found amongst the most irregular of the petty states of India, at least in his view. Perhaps the most dangerous form of corruption he discovered was the extent of gun running, where small fortunes had been made by English settlers and some Boers selling firearms to the Amaxhosa. Pottinger put a stop to that pretty swiftly with a permanent cure. Anyone found gun running would be shot on the spot, he warned. The settlers and locals were outraged by the allegations when they eventually appeared in local newspapers. One columnist wrote, "How long, we ask, is this callous unprincipled libeller to bask like a crocodile in the sunshine of the favour of Her Majesty's government?" However, it was how Pottinger was going to treat the Khoi Khoi living at the Cut River settlement that would lead to an uprising. The new governor had already been rude to the Boers, who he accused of insubordination, as they refused to join his new army raiding the Amaxhosa. He ordered 400 Khoi Khoi soldiers to be signed up from the Cut River settlement, but the officer he sent there returned with about a dozen. This man from Hong Kong was going to destroy the settlement in a rage, a wrathful exercise that really has to be heard to be believed. Already a man of anger, this man of empire, steeped in the rule of the European over everyone else, was going to lead to repercussions that stunned the missionaries. Pottinger turned his fullest frustration on the Cut River settlement, forcibly conscripting virtually every man, leaving the women and children alone. Within a few months, all their oxen, cows, sheep and goats were gone. Every able-bodied Khoi Khoi male from the age of 16 to 60 had been called up. 90% of the males living at the Cut River settlement were forced into Pottinger's army, whereas for the other groups providing the men, it was more like 3% of the total. Like the Boers, the Khoi Khoi from the Cut River served in the British army without pay. Pottinger had stopped their rations in a kind of spiteful madness. Even Henry Somerset pleaded with Pottinger to hand out rations to the women and children who'd remained behind at the settlement, but Sir Henry was nothing if not a sociopath. Pottinger wrote to Grey defending his actions, saying the Khoi Khoi were idle paupers, a shameful and ignorant comment, provocative and unwise. A terrible hatred was brewing in the hearts of the Khoi Khoi subjected to the British governor's callousness as they watched their children begin to starve. The British were going to pay for their disingenuous approach to South African affairs, not for the first time, nor for the last. The British now raided the Cut River settlement, the home of their allies. Well, not for long. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platform. It helps elevate the visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load an update about this episode. You can also email me from there. Until next, tot ziens.